I'm Steve Kraske of a Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. When the weather finally decides to turn cold, it'll happen sometime, you'll need some good books to keep you company by the heater. This hour, the book doctors are here with their recommendations for a good fall read. From a young poet's journey of self-discovery in Spain to the marriage dilemma of a gay couple, their selections cover a wide range of topics. You'll find some familiar authors' offerings are on our list, along with some fresh faces as we help you fill up your fall reading list on Up to Date, following this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, it's the height of the fall book season, and all kinds of new titles are on the shelves. We'll talk about a bunch of good ones with our book doctors who are in the house. We'll talk about The Roundhouse, Barbara Kingsolver's new one. It's called Flight Behavior, and the book The Commitment by Dan Savage. The book doctors today are freelance writer, editor, and reviewer Jeffrey Ann Gowdy. Jeff, nice to have you.
Good to be here, Steve.
Good morning. Grace Suh is back. She's a writer and editor. Grace, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
Also here is Mark Luce. He's chair of the English department at the Barstow School and teaches literature and writing over at KU. And Mark, always good to have you too.
Great. Very happy to be here.
Well, it is the height of the fall book season. All kinds of new titles are on the shelves. Mark, what's sort of got you thinking and rambling and excited as you look ahead to what's coming out here?
I think the one that I'm most excited to read is the new Michael Chabon novel called Telegraph Avenue, which seems to me set in Berkeley and tracing the record industry about 2003, 2004. So when the big boxes start moving in and the local record stores start moving out. My hunch is, I mean, I just looked at it for like 2 or 3 minutes. The prose, as always, is very sophisticated but also accessible. That seems to be his calling card. In the same vein, another wonderful writer who has a new book out, I think it came out last month, is Alice Munro, the Canadian short story writer who basically just spins gold onto the page. And then
her book is coming out November 13th.
Oh, it's not out yet.
Not out yet.
Okay.
No.
And then I also saw that Ian McEwan has a new book coming out called Sweet Tooth. And he does lots of different things, so he's always a good person to check out.
Tell us a little more about Mr. Chabon.
Well, he's written, oh goodness, I don't know. I read his first novel was Mysteries of Pittsburgh. His most famous book is probably The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay, which won the National Book Award and got second place at the National Book Critics Circle Award. And the only reason I know that is because I was sitting on the stage and watched his face fall in disappointment when he didn't get.
Ooh.
And we had a little bit of correspondence, and he would always say, like, I'll never forget that night and the sadness, you know. And but he won the Pulitzer for that.
Cavalier
so it's like, you know, well. Okay, hey, man, sorry. Yeah. You know, sorry you didn't get this no cash prize. He started off more as a sort of a New Yorker literary fiction type of work, and over time he's really sort of pushed much more fascination with genre literature and comics, and does all kinds of things kind of off the beaten path. So he's one of my favorites. So I really
problems in life is that everything is interesting to me. And when you talk about the era he's writing about and the music stores and how the music industry is changing, now that really is intriguing to me.
Now this is set in like a vinyl store, right?
It is.
But is it contemporary or is
No, it's in the 70s.
It's in the 70s, sort of.
It was 2000. I thought it was 2004. It starts in the 70s.
And it follows the friendship between the two owners, who one is black and one is white. And so it follows them from the 70s to the current age.
You know, it's funny. I mean, the thing is, he and who wrote Motherless Brooklyn?
Jonathan Lethem.
Those two, they have this bizarre, almost. It's not, I don't think it's a rivalry, but their books tend to be like one guy will write one and then the other guy will answer. Because Fortress of Solitude, right, is a story that contains tons of music.
The black and white characters.
And has a black and white character. I mean, they seem to always be I don't know if they're riffing off of each other. I mean, I think Chabon's a more talented writer, but he's also a little more – he takes up more space.
So you're looking forward to this one hitting your shelves.
For me, Thanksgiving break. So that's when
– You already have it planned out.
Oh, yeah.
I like that about you. I like that. Yeah. Jeff, what's coming up that you're excited about? Let's go there first.
What's coming up in the future is Barbara Kingsolver's Flight Behavior. And this book is actually coming out as a one-day laydown on November 6th.
What does that mean? That's
exactly.
Your book talk.
We can ask Grace, who worked as an editor for Knopf. I think it means that booksellers sort of take a pledge that they won't sell the book before November 6th to build anticipation for the book.
That won't happen.
Is that right?
That will not happen.
But anyway, everyone's always at the door of the bookstores.
Yeah, Bob Woodward has a new book out, and of course, like the Post or the New York Times gets an advance, you know, copy. They sneak a copy somehow a week ahead of time, and they spoil the one-day laydown or whatever it is.
Yeah. Okay. So I haven't written my review yet for the Kansas City Star, but I'll give you some teasing information about it if you want it, because I read it. Okay. But this is Barbara Kingsolver's 14th book, and she and her family live on a sheep farm in rural Virginia, and this is about an extended family that lives on a sheep farm in eastern Tennessee. And it features a really engaging character named Delarobia Turnbow, who...
say that again.
Delarobia.
Delarobia.
Delarobia. Isn't
Never
that a southern name?
Delarobia
Turnbow. And when she was 17, she got pregnant and got involved in a shotgun wedding. That's an antiquated term, isn't it? Anyway, she got married, and she married a guy that kind of lacks some imagination. His nickname is Cub, and his father's name is Bear, and that sort of captures the whole dynamic there. Anyway, she's the more active of the couple, and she's stuck in this marriage at 28, and she is heading up a mountain to go to a planned tryst with a much younger telephone lineman. And
why not?
Yeah, exactly.
All good romance stories sort of begin that way, don't they? Yeah.
Those telephone linemen. Anyway, she gets up on the mountain, and she is stopped in her tracks by acres and acres of what look like orange flames. And being of a somewhat religious bent, not as much as her husband's family, but a little bit that way herself, she initially thinks it's a miracle. In fact, it is acres and acres of monarch butterflies.
Oh.
Now, Kingsolver writes in her author's note that the factual basis of this story is in 2010 in a Mexican town that I'm sure I will not pronounce correctly, Angangueo. There were tremendous amount of rainfall. A mudslide destroyed the town, killed 30 people, and it was a portal for monarch butterflies and the migration of monarch butterflies. So that's the factual basis of the story, and then Kingsolver invents the rest, which is that these butterflies from Mexico overwintered in southern Appalachia. Don't want to tell too much and give too much away because I have to write my review yet. But anyway, this book takes on the urban-rural divide, the still-simmering controversy over climate change, which is still questioned in some quarters, I understand. It also really takes on how balkanized we're becoming in our country and just talking to people who share our political beliefs and are increasingly unable to talk to people across the divide. This book kind of reminded me of Prodigal Summer. Prodigal Summer was sort of her ode to moss. This is sort of her ode to butterflies. Prodigal Summer had an environmental crisis and a little sexy subplot, and this book has an environmental crisis and a little sexy subplot, not with the telephone lineman, mind you, but with a visiting scientist.
You know, put Barbara Kingsolver sort of on our on the list of the great American authors these days. Where does she sort of rank? At least from your
vantage
That
is a
point.
Great question. She's actually been snubbed somewhat by the literary community.
Because
some critics think that, as some, I think it was somebody for Slate or Salon said about Prodigal Summer, it was driven by an ideological engine.
Yeah, I've heard that.
And I think that some people will say that about Flight Behavior. I always think, hey, it's my engine. I like it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, in parts it does get a little didactic. But it's a wonderful page-turner, and the lessons that it's teaching, I think that we do need to learn. She did win the Orange Prize for The Lacuna, which is her most recent novel, and actually the last Orange Prize. It's never going to be given again. And that's sort of her major literary award
what was
that
her,
she's gotten.
What was her early famous book?
Bean Trees.
Bean Tree.
Yeah, the one after that. Wasn't there another one after that?
Bean Trees, Pigs in Heaven, Poisonwood Bible. And it's actually my favorite. I love the Poisonwood Bible.
Because?
It's deep. It's just deep and political, and it seems deeper to me than some of her other books.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my husband believes that Poisonwood Bible gets hijacked at the end by ideology, but I didn't find it that way.
Yeah. And that's great. I appreciate that. That's the latest from Barbara Kingsolver. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're visiting with our book doctors. And we're wondering if you've read a good book lately, a new book that you think others might enjoy as well. We certainly can give us a call here, 816-235-2888. We're looking for some good recommendations today. Our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us a title at @KCURUpToDate. Before we go into your list, Grace, so what books are you looking forward to coming out this fall? Is there anything coming that you're aware of that you're sort of geared up for? Because I got one.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, because mine was going to be the Alice Munro, and Mark took it.
Tell us, Alice Munro is really revered almost in literary circles for the short story, right?
But they're not really short. I mean, that's the thing.
They're novellas.
Yeah, they're novellas. They're short stories. 50 to 70 pages usually. Wouldn't you say 40 to 80 pages?
Yeah, and it's not just the fact that they run long for short stories. It's also that they feel really condensed. So in 40 pages, you feel like you read a novel, and they're very concentrated and. Nobody. The thing about Alice Munro is that nobody else does what she does. It's interesting because I'm bringing an old book today, Sam the Cat, and the particular reason I went to it is because I was writing and I thought I need to know how to do this. And sometimes I'll read an author to learn how they do it, but I've never tried that with Alice Munro because I just do not believe you can learn anything from her because she is seamless. Spinning gold is exactly the right way to say it.
You can't learn anything from her because, what, she's so good, you're saying? Or?
Yeah, she's you don't see any you don't see the craft. You just see the
with her, she's so good at, I mean, in some ways her stories are all kind of mundane. I mean, they're normal people kind of doing normal things. There's no explosions, there's tragedy certainly, but nothing loud, but you never, you're there, you're in it, you know them, and there are very few people I think that you don't hear. A lot of times with authors, you hear the gears grind. So
that's
when
what
they
I mean by
when
seeing
they,
the craft.
Yeah, when they're getting ready to shift, and you're like,
yeah,
you're like,
yeah.
Oh man.
I think reading one of her stories is like inhabiting a dream.
Yeah,
and somehow the wisdom of the ages gets compressed in mm-hmm. there, and mm-hmm. she doesn't skirt from any truth.
Well,
and her stories have become increasingly darker.
Yeah, they have. And she's mm-hmm. as she's gotten older. I think another thing that actually sort of helps her is she doesn't play the game. She doesn't.
That's right.
She doesn't go to New York. She doesn't.
She doesn't, tweet.
She doesn't do anything. She writes. She writes, or she lives her life up in the middle of nowhere, out in the Western Canada,
yeah.
in the middle of nowhere,
yeah.
and she doesn't. She doesn't really care about that stuff. She likes writing her books.
Talk a little bit about the whole art of brevity, because as a guy who sort of works in that world of having to be brief all the time, in a world occupied by folks who are anything but brief, everyone wants to talk and yammer and tell long stories. Here she is. She's made a career and a distinguished career based on this notion of, you know, short stories that might be short novellas for sure, but there's a real craft in, I mean, just an amazing ability to say so much in so little space, which
well,
I've always admired so
absolutely.
Much.
Absolutely. And it's very rare to become as well known as she is purely on stories.
I think she has one novel, right? Early on.
Yeah, I guess so. I don't know.
Rest,
I mean, it's kind of, to me, she's like Eudora Welty, who also had one, two novels, but the novels were never what made her name. It was always mm-hmm. the stories. And
so if you like Alice Munro, you might like Eudora Welty.
Oh, absolutely. And if you like both of those, call me because you'll be my best friend.
Really?
Because those are two of my absolute favorite writers. Yes. Yeah. And I think, Jeffrey Ann, you said it so well when you said, you know, it's like inhabiting, because that is the crucial word. She's never manufacturing a world. She's never cooking up a story. It's like she taps in. She just taps into this place in life, and she's a direct conduit to it.
Kind of like a telephone lineman.
Who's very sexy.
Bring this conversation around full circle, Mark. Yes. I just – you said that so well. I just admire that so much, the older I get, and being able to communicate so effectively, which is just such an amazing thing.
I will tell you another thing about Alice Munro is that she's not a young person's writer.
When That's right.
I read her my first year of graduate school, we read Moons of Jupiter, and I'm like, you know, what is this? Like, I don't like this.
Because
I don't understand the subject matter. I'm a 21, 22-year-old kid. I have no idea about love and marriage and
motherhood.
Yeah, 28. Yeah, well, that's, I'm 28.
And the limitations exactly. of being a woman in her time and place.
Well, and that's a whole other thing. I mean, she's writing Moons of Jupiter is like 1977, 1978. And so I'm not in touch with, you know, like first wave fem. I mean, I have no idea. I'm a silly, like, self-indulgent graduate student.
Today, how do you feel about her?
Today, I think I think it's beautiful. I mean, I think it's absolutely stunning. And the thing with her, it's like if I'm going to read her, I want no one around. Mm-hmm. I want to know that I can finish one of the stories. Like, I don't, mm-hmm. I don't like reading her four pages here, four pages there. My wife's crazy about it.
What is the story that she has? I can't remember the title right now, about the elderly women who are dressed in brocade, who teach piano. Mm. And it's about an afternoon recital, but it's just stunning, absolute stunning.
Mm.
A kid comes in who is disabled in some way mentally, but is like a savant and sits down and plays the most amazing piece ever. And it's just brilliant.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the amazing work of Alice Munro as we visit with our book doctors today, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Grace Suh, and Mark Luce. Our phone number here, we're looking for your recommendations for good new books, 816-235-2888. Our email address is up to date at kcur.org. You know, and I'm sitting here as you guys are talking, I'm thinking, okay, Alice Munro, I'd like to read some of her. And I'm really looking forward to, I already have a copy of it, David von Draeli's new book, 1862. We're going through this new revival, I guess, again, ongoing revival of Abraham Lincoln, all things Lincoln, the new Spielberg movie coming out this fall. I've already seen Coming Attractions for it twice. Looks very, very good. Daniel Day-Lewis as the lead role here. And so, but David, who lives locally, is a buddy of mine, I should point out, but writes for Time Magazine, has this new book out on this very crucial year. And that was going to be a book he's going to be on the show here in a couple of weeks. I'm looking forward to really diving into that one. I've got a bunch of new books.
What is he looking at in particular? I mean, is he looking at it in a macro view, or is he looking at like one thing and kind of spinning 1862 out of that one thing?
He takes, if I remember correctly, Mark, he takes 1862 by the month. He walks us through that year month by month and all the things that happened that year. The book is titled Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln in America's Most Perilous Year, not titled 1862, but he takes it month by month, and he'll be on the show here in a couple of weeks to talk about it. So, yeah.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it will be great. Kathy writes this on KCUR's Facebook page. A few years ago, I read Drood by Dan Simmons. It's a perfect January read. Gloomy, gray, English countryside, damp, dark, underground London. This sounds good to me, too. It all sounds good. Collins, Dickens, opium, ghosts, and the creepy Mr. Drood all make for a great winter's tale. I plan on rereading it again this winter. Are you guys familiar with Drood by Dan Simmons?
Sorry.
No, but I have a creepy, foggy London book.
Do you? What is
it? Yeah, it's called The Lodger. It was written in 1914 by Marie-Belloc Lowndes, which rhymes with Towns. I learned earlier, and it is the story of Jack the Ripper. So plenty of fog in this book. Actually, it was published in 1914, sorry. So Lowndes was a famous thriller writer, and she wrote all kinds of stuff, but this was her most famous. It's the sort of the most famous fictional treatment of Jack the Ripper. So a lodger, gasp, shows up, and a couple is down on their luck. And they're former servants, and they can't seem to get jobs. And so out of nowhere, this lodger appears, right, saving them from fiscal ruin. But then the suspense happens because we all know who the lodger actually is, and then tension mounts. One of the – a great – a wonderful thriller. I'm teaching a class on 19th century crime and detection. And so this is one of the books that we're reading for that.
Is it too late to enroll?
Yeah, where's your class?
No, it's at Edwards Campus, room 150-something, 152. I don't know. I just go there.
How did you start teaching that class? Sounds so interesting.
You know, they one of the things that KU's done that's really nice for their for lecturers over it, they let me sort of explore the areas that I'm interested in for the – like I do a nonfiction writing class every spring. But on the literature side, they let me kind of – so I've done graphic novels, I've done modern American drama, like things that I'm sort of interested in intellectually that I don't necessarily have the chance to explore sort of in the high school level. So I'd done the noir, just a straight up, you know, 20s to 50s noir. And then in this case, I didn't really know the history of, you know, when does crime writing start? How does it start? What fuels it? And so I started with Poe and we just sort of made our way. And that you see the way that the genre develops is actually quite fascinating. And there's wonderful, wonderful books. The Leavenworth Case by Anna Catherine Green was a very fun kind of whodunit. All the Doyle stories, Raffles, The Amateur Cracksman, Arsène Lupin, Fantomas. It's really – I mean, to be honest, the class is just kind of a kick in the pants for me. It's just like everything's rollicking. And it's surprisingly – there's plenty sort of class-wise, political-wise, and certainly gender-wise to talk about.
We're looking for your good recommendations for new books that you've read and can give us your 2 cents on. 816-235-2888 and our email address, update@kcur.org. Lori Hayes writes this: I'm reluctantly decided to read The Night Circus and ended up loving the book. I say reluctantly because I usually stay far, far away from popular fiction because 95% of the time I am disappointed. This book was the 5% exception. Night Circus by Irving?
Morgenstern.
Okay.
Laura Morgenstern.
Yeah. And?
You know, I reviewed it for the Kansas City Star, and it's not my usual kind of book. It's a lot of magic, and I think the publishers sort of were anointing her as the next J.K. Rowling. But it's actually her powers of description were gorgeous. It's a really lushly imagined book, and I thoroughly enjoyed it.
Wow. Okay. Yeah.
Well, I recently read a popular fiction, which is not at all my usual. So I'm along with your listener. But I had so many people tell me that I had to read it that I finally did. And I'm talking about Gillian Flynn's Gone Girl. Mm. And she happens to be, I'm told, a Kansas City native.
Yeah.
And I think Steve Paul is about to do a feature on her for Kansas City Star. So like I said, I'm not usually a thriller reader. I'm not usually a popular fiction reader.
Why not, Grace? Because you strike me as a thrilling kind of woman. You know, what's the deal?
Let's just keep that between you and me.
Okay.
I'm just more of a what used to be called a mid-list reader. I'm more of a literary fiction person. Yeah. I come from literary criticism and so... Why not? Because I don't usually find them that terribly interesting. Mm. And because, you know, someone tried to get me to read Twilight of all things. And out of friendship to her, I really did try. And I have to say, if something is not well written, I don't care if it's the most interesting subject in the world, I cannot read it. I cannot without denting my wall because I throw the book so often.
Yeah.
No way.
Yeah.
So I picked this up and... I don't think that she is the best writer in the world as far as, you know, literary quality goes. I think she really knows how to manipulate a reader and manipulate a plot.
Yeah.
And it's certainly, I have to say, speaking of kick in the pants, it was a real kick in the pants for me because when I'm not reading literary fiction, I'm reading nonfiction. A lot of what I read I don't bring in here because it's just not of general interest. I read a lot of 16th and 17th century Korean and East Asian history and a lot of art history. 17th century Dutch art history is what I've been reading. That's my bedside stack.
Yeah.
And I don't know that it's that interesting to the general public. But so what I'm saying is I'm not used to books that fly. And this book flew. I read it in about 36 hours, not counting eating and sleeping.
So you liked it?
Well, Steve, that's a hard question to answer.
Yes, the answer is yes.
Yes, she liked it. She feels guilty about it.
She feels guilty
no,
for liking it.
Yes. Yeah.
That's what it is.
It's okay, Grace.
She knows
it's
that
okay.
it's...
You're here among friends.
We,
it's okay.
We have... There's a thing. When you do criticism or where your life sort of spins around books, there are times that when people can't write, it's very hard. It's very hard to keep going. But then there are also times where you know they can't write, but the story's so much fun, you just stay with it. The one I always think of is The Da Vinci Code, which that guy
– Oh, you did not.
I did. And you know what? That guy is the worst writer that I think I
– Dan Brown.
Oh, my God. Just dreadful. But that book – and it's implausible. It's I could not put it down.
I have lost all respect for Mark.
I'm reading sentences
to
Jen. Like, look at how bad this is. But I just kept plowing through it.
I'm
embarrassed. It's like
it's
a Hunt for Red October. It's the same kind of thing.
So, but in this book, the wife leaves the husband.
Okay, I'm going to say this. It kept me reading so fast. It reminded me of being a little kid.
Give us a quick look at the plot.
Well, there's a wife who disappears.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
And all fingers point. It's your classic on TV breaking news, and all fingers point to the husband.
Mm.
Blood all over the kitchen.
People always blame the husband.
Well, that's what the book is exactly about. That
rightly
the,
so.
That people always blame the husband.
Mm-hmm.
And there's blood all over the kitchen, and he has been unfriendly to her. It's their anniversary, and he hasn't even bought a gift yet. He didn't even make restaurant reservations, whereas she is this adoring wife, and she keeps this diary all about how much she loves him, but why isn't he loving her back? And she has this present for him, and then she disappears, and things look very, very bad for him. And it's told from alternating points of view, his and hers, and it goes through several huge plot twists, which are all predictable.
Is there a one-armed man?
Well, we have another reviewer on the line here, Alice from Lawrence, who also wants to talk about Gone Girl. Alice, what did you think of it?
Hello. I kind of have some of the same ideas as your reviewer. Like when they said you like the book, it's kind of one of those books where you read it, and at least for me, I was so mad at it, but I could not stop putting it down. I read it. Like she said, you know, just like my son luckily was at daycare, so I could just finish it. That's awful to say, but I had to finish it real quick. I totally went along with it. So you said it was totally predictable. I feel a little dumb, but I totally fell for it. And I was thinking, yeah, it's not really that well written in the beginning. It's kind of like Dateline. But then the twist happens, and I had totally fallen for it.
Need to read more Law. You need to watch more Law and Order.
Yeah, I don't watch that show. But it was one of those books where I wanted someone else to read it so I could talk to them about it and be mad at the author with that other book.
Yeah, no, I'm mad at the author too. I dislike her intensely.
Yeah.
I got to the end and I thought, I cannot believe I read this book because it is very disappointing at the end.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
She strings you along and strings you along.
But they're going to make it into a movie. I will go see that.
Okay, that book again. Thank you, Alice. That book again is titled Gone Girl. Grace bid on it and sort of had mixed feelings about it. Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a whole bunch of new books. We'll also talk about how our reviewers find time. How do they decide what they're going to read next? I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star. And you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And we are back. If you missed yesterday's conversations with web cartoonist Matt Inman, who's got like 750,000 Twitter followers, and about KCUI's new airport terminal plans. You can find those in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, veterinarian Dr. Wayne Hunhausen is back. He'll take your questions about pets and pet behavior. There's no one better at it than Wayne Hunhausen. This hour, we're visiting with our book doctors. They are Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Grace Suh, and Mark Luce. And let's run through some books you guys have been reading of late. And if our folks, listeners, want to call in and chime in with their own recommendations for good books they've read lately, 816-235-2888. And our email address is up to date at kcur.org. Mark Luce, take it away.
The book that I'd like to talk about first actually kind of holds a special place for me. Last Saturday, an art show opened at the Nelson Atkins called Hartley and the Photographs of Terry Evans. Terry Evans, well, I'm lucky enough. I went to school to grades, junior high and high school with her son. Her son and I have known each other for years. We're dear friends.
Wow.
And so me and my wife and our friends Phil and Sally, also from Salina, all got to go to the opening, and it was wonderful. And you know, when you're a kid, when you're 14, 15, and your friend's mom has a book, it's sort of the, you know, it's like, wow, she makes us turkey sandwiches, but she has a book. And, you know, her pictures have been in Life magazine. And so being able to see the work on the wall at the Nelson was just sort of overwhelming for me. I had written about her years ago for Kansas Alumni Magazine and was lucky enough to go flying. She does a lot of aerial photography. And I was terrified because I was in the back of a little tiny plane that moved around like an ice skate, you know. And she's leaning out the window shooting pictures. And one of the shots from that day is actually in the show. So
oh,
I was
you're
just
kidding.
I was just tickled.
That's neat.
You know, and I'm just going, this is so cool. This is so cool. But the book for the show is it's not the same as seeing the pictures at the museum because they're so large scale. But she documents basically life on the plains in all kinds of different facets, right? Aerial photography from Canada to Texas, lots of stuff in the Flint Hills. Portraits of people she documented Matt Field Green a couple different times over the years.
Mm.
And then she's done
Green?
Chicago. She just had a thing for there. I mean, and for the plains. And then in Chicago, old steel mills. She photographed a bunch of specimens from the Field Museum. And just a sort of fascinating look at 40 years of photography. And so the book for that is out. And the senior curator of photography, Keith Davis, is sort of the main. Sort of leads the charge on that. And so I would highly suggest getting over there, one, to see the show, but also to take that book home because it will absolutely fascinate.
Well, word on the street, in this case, Belinder Court, where I live, is that this is a show that's definitely worth going to check out.
I grew up in the middle of the state, and so a lot of the stuff she shoots I'm very familiar with. And, you know, I shoot too, and I shoot more of built landscape really than the actual landscape, and so she's a tremendous sort of influence on me.
Oh, it's neat that you're such a good connection with her.
It was pretty cool.
Is she in Chicago now?
She's in Chicago. She moved there. I can't remember. It was after college, after I was in college, so 92, 93. Her son did work for Mercy Corps. David was a country director in Iraq for the last 3 years. And now he's moving. He just moved the other day to Liberia for International Rescue Committee, country director. It's like a hot – I guess he just likes the hot spots.
Wow. Good new books is our topic today. Jeff Ann Gowdy, what do you have up there to talk about?
This book, The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich, I reviewed for the Kansas City Star about a month ago, and it is newly a finalist for the National Book Award, which will be announced in the fiction category. And these awards will be announced on my birthday, November 14th. And I am rooting for Erdrich.
As they should be.
In any case, this is Erdrich's 14th novel. And this is a more tightly focused novel than some of her early works, just like her last one, Shadow Tag. And also, as in Shadow Tag, there's no quote marks around the dialogue, which sort of reinforces this feeling of sublimated rage and bitten off humor because it is a dark topic. It's narrated by a 13-year-old boy, and he does it from the perch of adulthood, but it totally captures an adolescent boy's sensibility. But it's the summer of 1988, and his mother is late returning with a folder from work on a Sunday afternoon. He and his father go out and look for her, and then they see her, and they kind of trail her home. She is bloody and beaten when she gets home. She reeks of gasoline. She's been savagely raped, and her attacker has tried to set her on fire.
Yeah.
Yeah. The boy's father is Basil Coutts, who is a tribal judge, and the boy's mother is Geraldine, who is a tribal enrollment specialist. And between the two of them, they know a lot of secrets about the residents of the reservation in North Dakota, where they live, and also the small town that borders it. Basil thinks that probably the attacker has something to do with a case that he has decided, but Geraldine's head was shrouded at the time of the attack, so they don't really know where it occurred, on tribal land, state land, or federal land. And Joe looks at his father and the jurisdictional issues, and that he seems to be unable to do anything about the attacker as his identity emerges. And he and his trio of buddies decide to take revenge into their own hands. Revenge has a very high cost for Joe and especially his best friend. Now, this makes it sound very dark, but it's also...
And also very conventional. I mean, I've heard that story before, haven't we? I mean, not to...
Well, you know, the rape of Native women is something that really propelled Erdrich to take this on. And Erdrich is, again, compresses a lot, and her writing is highly poetic, but she is a funny, darkly funny writer, and also a real raunchy writer in this book. There is a grandfather, Musham, who occurs in other books, who's very randy, even at 110. There is a raunchy grandma, whom the boys cannot even say certain words around because it will set her off, like bony, a simple word like bony. Yeah, you can't say that around grandma in Asia Thunder. And there's also a scene that doesn't sound like it would be funny, but it is darkly funny, in which the boys are peeping on a priest that they initially suspect is the rapist, and he bags the boys and cusses them in the most colorful language possible, but without resorting to profanity. It is a brilliant book. It's a brilliant.
I
love
again
Erdrich. The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich.
And producer Stephen Seidman will put all our titles up on our website after the show today.
I love
Yeah.
I loved it.
Does it? You know, her best known work is Love Medicine, right? Isn't that her?
Yeah, it won the National Book Critics Circle Award.
Is it the same, like thematically, is it similar? Because I don't know her work that way. I mean,
actually,
I've taught Love Medicine.
It's a departure. I mean, Love Medicine is sort of these rotating points of view,
right,
and very collagey. This is, I guess, and you would say it is a more conventional novel for her. It's sort of structured like a thriller and more tightly focused. But it is extremely effective. And, of course, Erdrich has imagined this postage stamp of North Dakota in all of its detail. You know, people compare her to Faulkner.
And with her own country.
And so she is constantly leafing out this intricate family tree and layering on story after story after story. But there's a deepening effect, and I think it's absolutely brilliant. And I hope she gets the National Book Award.
Wow.
She book in this series, Shadow Tag, kind of interrupted it, was The Plague of Doves, which is a finalist for the Pulitzer. So I hope she gets in it. A sobering postscript to the book is that she thanks her daughters at the end of the book in an author's note for taking care of her when she had breast cancer in the writing of the book. And sort of one reviewer said it kind of reinforces this idea of kids making sacrifices for their parents. And
a couple of emails here. Jody writes about Alice Munro. She writes, I read Too Much Happiness and I made myself finish it but found it so depressing. What would you recommend from her that isn't quite so dark? You're shaking your head, Mark. Like,
I mean, Love Medicine is, I mean, that conventionally that's her.
Now we're talking about Munro.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Now we're talking about Munro. That Too Much Happiness is dark.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the later books, and there is murder and crime. And it is dark. Any of the early works.
What's the Friends one?
Dancing with the Happy. We could look it up. Any of the early collections.
We have this email from Richard who writes, could the book doctors recommend some great reads by local writers? Jeff?
Okay, I brought in a book by a local author, Leaving the Atocha Station by Ben Lerner, which Steve Paul brought in earlier this year. Ben is a Topeka boy, and I have a disclaimer here. I read the book in manuscript, but not for pay. And when Steve brought it in, it was in paperback form from a small press, and it got such critical acclaim that it was brought out in hardback by Granta. James Wood of The New Yorker calls it subtle, sinuous, very funny. Jonathan Franzen says it's original in every sentence. It won the Believer Book Award.
And the title again is?
Leaving the Atocha Station by Ben Lerner. It's absolutely brilliant.
And it's about what?
It's about a character in his 20s. It's very much a coming-of-age book. He's in Madrid on a grant at the time of the 2004 bombings of the Atocha Station. Mm-hmm. And he's questioning his own authenticity. There are problems in translation because he's in Spain. But also it's just about the difficulty of communicating truthfully and authentically in any language. It's a little bit too like occupying somebody's head. Mm-hmm. It's about a character who is worried that he's unfeeling, but in fact he has such a multiplicity of feelings. There's so much nuance here. So it's Virginia Woolfish. Also a little side note, Ben has a lead article in the October Harper's in which he talks about growing up in Topeka and participating in high school debate and forensics. And he takes a leap there and links it to political speech. Sort of the sped-up, jargon-laced policy debate and dissects that and his experience with that and the sort of the folksiness of political speech like Sarah Palin-esque.
Yeah. Okay. Any other local books you guys would recommend? Or?
Well, I mean, I think you know, either of Whitney Terrell's books, King of Kings County or The Huntsman are both very sort of solid literary fiction.
The King of Kings County is just an amazing book.
I really like that book.
Yeah.
So either one of those, I think, would be solid.
Very good. Okay, let's move on to Grace Sa. I always try to separate the first from the last name so people don't think I'm saying Grace Sha.
It does elide.
I bet, yes. It's Grace Sa. Grace, what do you have here for us?
Well, to return to Foggy London as well as dark humor, I read Hilary Mantel's Wolf Hall. Two things. First of all, when I say I read, it was my first audiobook experience. Mm. Well, I've done nonfiction audiobooks in the car.
And how was it for you?
It was fantastic because it was read really well. And I
can't wrap my arms around the idea of that, man.
Well, I couldn't either. And I had always made a distinction between nonfiction, audiobooks.
Yeah.
We've done that before. We've listened to Michael Pollan and David Rakoff on audiobook and literature. But it's a 600-page book, and it's so big, and my tables are leaning with books, and I just thought, I'm just going to try it. It was my experiment, and it was fantastic.
Hmm.
It's really well written. It flew over, 30 hours. And it's just such a fantastic book, and I really, really loved it.
And you can appreciate it as much having heard it as you would have if you had read it?
Well, I think it depends a lot on the book. And this book is it's very conversational because it's always in the voice of Thomas Cromwell, who is its protagonist and point of view throughout. And so this is Tudor England, and he is the head counselor to King Henry VII, and I normally wouldn't read anything like that, but this is – I don't think anyone could call it really historical fiction. And it won the Booker in 2009, and the follow-up, the sequel, just won the Booker for Bringing Out the Bodies. And it is very much literary fiction, and it's very – obviously it's historical fiction because it's set in a time and place, but – it transcends all of those categories. It's one of the best books I've read definitely this year.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's fantastic. The character of Thomas Cromwell is one of the best characters I've read in a really long time.
Wow.
So vivid and so vibrant and so complex and really, really likable, even though all one's life one hears about what a horrible, manipulative, evil, amoral man he is. And but in this book, he is completely human and humanistic, and And very thoughtful. And by thoughtful, I don't mean kind. I mean someone who thinks through everything in his life, and you are in his mind the whole time. And at the end of these 600 pages, I can't wait for the next 600 page installment.
Wow! What a high recommendation. Again, it's just hard for me to imagine getting that wrapped up in an audiobook. People do. I mean,
Here's a question I have about audiobooks. I've actually never listened to an audiobook, and I think my fear is that my mind would drift.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I mean, when you're reading,
me too.
Yeah,
me too.
It's active, and you have to stay on the page. And I have a drifty mind, and I'm kind of worried that.
Well, you know, first of all, I listened to it when I was doing things that my mind didn't need to be on. So I folded a lot of socks, and I cleaned a lot of kitchen while I was reading listening to this book. And you know, there's nothing like it for when you're doing menial. Mm-hmm. quotidian tasks to take your mind to this other place. But also it is such a beautifully written, vivid book that I was gripped. It was more gripping than a thriller. But I will say, as far as audiobooks go, then I tried Moby Dick, which is another book I brought in.
Oh.
And after only an hour, I thought, I'm going to stop, even though that was the audiobook that was recommended to me by a dear friend. I'm going to stop and get this book because I need to read it on paper because I was loving every other paragraph so much that I wanted to see it on the page.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. If our listeners have any thoughts about audiobooks versus conventional books, 816-235-2888. Nolan writes, if you enjoy historical fictions, Ken Follett's Century Trilogy is very well written and quite a joy to read. The first book, Fall of Giants, covers several families during the First World War. The second book just came out, Winter of the World. And he, of course, wrote the book Eye of the Needle, which I thought was just a very short novel, just terrific. Anyone Ken Follett fans here?
Mm.
Yeah, not really. Okay.
Nope.
Mark Luce, proceed.
Another book that, sorry, I'm in this British crime place, but 39 Steps by John Buchan. we know, most of us know 39 Steps from Hitchcock.
Yes.
And they're very different things. In the 39 Steps by Hitchcock, they get handcuffed together almost in a like it happened one night kind of way. And so John Buchan is a Scottish writer, and in many ways he sort of mirrors Doyle. He wanted to write histories and be considered sort of a literary guy, but he wrote this 39 Steps book, and it's a thriller slash espionage novel, and of course people love it. So then he's like, that's the mantle, right? That's what he gets stuck with. The same way that Doyle gets stuck with it and gets so frustrated that he kills off Holmes. Only people are so mad at him, he has to bring him back. So this is a story of a fellow named Richard Hannay, who has made a fortune in South Africa. He comes to London, and he's bored by it. The social life is not for him. He's not having a good time. When all of a sudden he's like, hey, I've got something for you. Right. So fast forward a couple days, the guy that he's going to help in this secret plan ends up dead. And then this mysterious group is chasing Richard all over the Scottish countryside. And what he's trying to do is stave off a German invasion, right? It's written on the eve of World War, the eve of World War I. All of the things that now we sort of consider standard or conventional, like the man who knows too much, right? And he's being chased by these forces that he doesn't quite understand, and he's reluctant to do it in the first place. All of those sort of tropes kind of show up in this book. And one of the things that's so fascinating about it is that Richard narrates it, and he's hysterical because he thinks that he's really sort of important and smart. But then when push comes to shove, he'll sort of admit that he really kind of doesn't know what he's doing. And so, the thing is, are they going to be able to find the place where the Germans are going to sort of get the secret message out and start their invasion?
Mm-hmm.
And so it's very self-aware, which I found surprising for a novel in 1945. 14. And you also see the role of technology in a way that you don't really see in any of the older sort of crime fiction. So here you have – so guy's running away and he'll steal a car and take off. And so they'll call to the next town like, hey, you know, look out for this guy wearing this disguise in this thing. And it's improbable in all kinds of places, but it is so much fun.
You know, lots of phone calls about audiobooks. Grace got things stirred up here. Maggie from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I like audiobooks because the few that I've listened to, it was almost like listening to a play. Mm. And as a musician, it's real important to listen. And so in the car, it's just perfect. But it was like the book that I listened to was The Shack. And this actor that read it did every character in a different voice. And others I've had were like monotone, and that was really bad. I couldn't hit it. But the other, I've listened to a few of them, and I just thought it was like listening to a play without having the visuals. And then I can picture my own visuals.
Yeah, that's neat. Maggie.
You know, so I do like audiobooks.
Thanks, Maggie. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Let's go to Aaron from Kansas City, Missouri. Aaron, you're on the show. Go quickly, Aaron. Just a few seconds left here.
It's a Game of Thrones, and I got the idea from the HBO series, but it's a great audio book. There's 5 books, and Roy Dotrice is the reader, and it's a great read. It's a great listen, too.
Oh, great recommendation, Aaron. Thank you. Let's go to Danny, Kansas City, Missouri. Danny, how are you?
I'm just great, you guys. Listen, this isn't about audiobooks, but I have a quick question for your panel. Did anybody read Richard Ford's latest, Canada, which I have done, and what do you guys think of it? Thank you.
I haven't. He used to be one of my favorite writers.
Used to be, yeah.
After the sports writer, I just sort of like, – I really liked him, like a Rock Springs, at Early Collection. I mean, he's good.
Danny, what did you think?
Oh, well, I'm biased because now and then back in Maine, I go fishing with the man, but I've read 4 of his novels, and I enjoy all of them, although I do admit Sports Writer is perhaps my favorite.
Yeah, okay, Danny, thank you very much, and we're out of time. We'll save our conversation about how to find time to read and how they decide, how our book doctors decide which books to read next for our next broadcast. Our book doctors today, Grace Saw, Jeffrey Ann Gowdy, Mark Luce, thank you all very much for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
You can find more information about our broadcast at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow on the program, veterinarian Dr. Wayne Hunhausen answers questions about your pets. The show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.